You're listening to The Profile.
Hello, and welcome to The Profile podcast. I'm Andy Peck. Maybe you have a leadership role, or maybe you're just seeking to use your influence in godly ways. You will know that leadership can be a bit of a roller coaster, wonderful highs, crushing lows, and an awful lot of daily grind. Sometimes you need advice and encouragement from people who can relate to your situation. This is why for the past 18 years I've been interviewing Christians in the world of leadership, from churches, charities, and commercial and non-commercial settings. I've been aiming to support Christians just like you, so you can honour God, who is our ultimate leader. I trust that this next conversation will be an inspiration to you. This show is brought to you by Premier Christianity Magazine, the UK's leading Christian magazine. Get full online access and the print magazine every month by becoming a subscriber. See special offers available now at premierchristianity.com. It is, of course, our contention on this show that all of us have influence. It's just whether we recognise it and how we use it. But it's also the case that some roles are especially influential. And I'm joined this week by someone who, at least theoretically, has an influential role as a head teacher. His name is Marcus Colverwell, and he is head teacher of Reigate St. Mary's Preparatory and Choir School. And in the interest of full disclosure, it is the school close to the church I attend, and indeed uses the church building as its choir base. So welcome, Marcus, to the Leadership Show.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're geographically the closest interview I've ever done, so you're just down the road from where I physically live.
Excellent.
So your route first, Marcus, to faith and into teaching.
Well, I probably, like many people listening to this show, I grew up in a church, and it was a Methodist church. My mother was a committed Christian, as was my grandfather on her side. My father was actually an atheist, so that was always an interesting dynamic. But I went to church, made a personal commitment at the age of 13. Then after that, was very involved in leading the youth in the church, and had various roles as I think I was chair of the Christian Union at school, and then co-president at university, and so on. So yes, probably came to faith as a result of a Louis Palau outreach mission in Croydon in, I think it's 1984. So
I remember it, 83 or 84,
around about that.
I think it was 80. Well, I remember the mission to London 84, if it was that one, certainly, yeah.
It probably was. So yes, nearly 40 years ago. My route into teaching was more accidental, really. I always loved mechanical things, and I trained as an engineer, did aeronautical mechanical engineering. And then when I graduated, there were no jobs in that area, so I thought I'd train to be a teacher of engineering, lecturer. So I trained to teach in sixth form college. And then there were no jobs in that area either, really. So I ended up teaching science in a prep school. I thought, well, this is rather good fun. You have quite a lot of influence, and the children are very receptive that age. And there's a lot of variety, not just the teaching, but the pastoral aspects as well. So I ended up staying in teaching, and then slowly progressed over the years. So, yes, almost by accident, but a really good accident, and I think a God accident, probably.
So you're head teacher of Reigate St. Mary's Preparatory and Choir School. Does the place of a choir that uses a church indicate a high proportion of those attending have Christian sympathies?
Yes, we're very unusual being a choir school. We're part of the Choir School Association. There's only about 40 of them in the entire country, and only two in the world that aren't affiliated to a cathedral. And it's as a result of the fact that Godfrey Searle, who owned the large house that then became a school and has subsequently grown, he had a passion for choral music. So when he died, he left the school for the education of choristers who could carry on singing a traditional style of matins and evensong service at St. Mary's over the road. So it's had this Christian tradition for many years. And even though the choristers now make up a very small percentage of the entire school, I think people in the area recognize it as a school that's not actually a church school, but is very much affiliated to the church. So those who come to join us will often have certainly sympathies with the Christian faith. And there are quite a few who do come here who certainly do worship over the road, but the majority are quite happy for their children to have the moral teachings of a church-based school, even though it's from other religions, which I find fascinating.
Sure.
I was talking to a parent actually a little while ago who sends his child to a school down the road, which is a Catholic school, even though he is a devout Muslim. And he says he would rather have the children having some biblical teaching than no spiritual religious teaching at all. So that was a fascinating conversation.
Yeah.
But yes, we do have quite a lot of Christians in the school, and occasionally we can have staff and parent prayer meetings, which is a real privilege.
Marcus, I said in my introduction, it would be easy to see how a head teacher might exert a Christian influence within a school setting. I'm guessing in practice, you'd have to be extremely careful. How do you see your faith alongside your role?
Yeah, I think I am. I know that colleagues who work in state schools, particularly in very multicultural areas, do have that quite strict tie on what they can and can't do and say. I am very blessed to be in a school where I can actually talk about faith and in services and even in assemblies in a gentle way, share the gospel. Got colleagues who can't do that at all, but what we can all do is work very hard to make sure that the children coming up through our schools have those moral values that will hopefully help them to be great citizens in the future. As I always say, to give back more to society than they take. Faith alongside my role, and I very much feel as though this job was given to me by God. Various doors opened at the time, and I won't go into the long drawn out details of how that unfolded. But I ended up as the head in this school 20 years ago now. And I feel truly blessed because, as I say, being a church-affiliated school, there are things I can do and share and have influence in, which I wouldn't have been able to if I'd been in a different school. One of the key things, actually, is about the curriculum. As an independent school, we're not tied to the national curriculum in the same way. Of course, we follow it. We follow the framework of it to make sure the children have a broad education. But there's a saying which I share quite often when I'm giving talks, and it goes like this. Why is it today that we value what we're told to measure rather than measuring what we truly value? And there is so much focus on getting the English and maths grades and results and certain hitting certain targets that the things that are most important in life tend to get pushed to the sidelines. It's not just Christians who say that relationships are at the heart of a good life. I think most people would agree with that. And yet developing good relationships and character building, helping young people to do things that are societal for good, the good of society, as opposed to just being rather narcissistic and having more of their own things. We can all teach that, and we all need to make sure that is at the heart of education. So opportunities that have come with my role have been absolutely brilliant. Well, one of the things that I got involved with quite a few years ago was called Education for Social Responsibility, ESR. And I read a book. It was called The Meaning of the 21st Century. And it was by an author called Dr. James Martin, who was at the time regarded as one of the top futurologists and is also regarded as the fourth most influential person in the world of computer science, a real strategic thinker. And he set up a faculty at Oxford University called the Oxford Martin Research Centre or Oxford Martin School. And it's got the most brilliant minds in the world looking at solving the problems of the 21st century. And a lot of those are ones that if people are familiar with today, like climate change and the scarcity of resources and so on. But there was a paragraph in the book which said, The general public are spectacularly ignorant about major scientific issues. And as a head teacher with a science background, I thought, surely not me. That can't be me. So I dug down into the topics and the issues that he had raised in his book that I read. And I thought, my goodness, he's absolutely right. I'm totally ignorant about really, really important things, which are going to have a huge impact on the rising generation. So I thought, if I'm ignorant, and probably means most heads are ignorant. And if the heads who direct and guide education in the country are fairly ignorant about these things, how is it ever going to change? Because we won't be teaching the children coming up through the school the changes that they need to make. So I started working on this ESR, Education for Social Responsibility. And within that, there are the various focus points. One of them is about ethical trade. One is about ecosystems and what they do to provide us with all we need to live. Climate change, water scarcity, biodiversity and a finite planet. In fact, you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. It just isn't possible. And yet that's our culture. It's all focused on growth. That's what we hear about in the news. The other key factor is called fulfilled lives. And as a Christian, we know that actually the fulfilled life is a relationship with God. We live out his purposes for our lives and through our lives. But even those people without faith, I think, fully understand that actually a fulfilled life comes through good relationships, giving back more than we take, helping those around us, spending time in nature, and so on. So putting that at the heart of education and everything else grows from that, I believe, is absolutely essential if we're going to change the status quo and have an economy that isn't business as usual, but business as unusual, where it's not totally focused on growth, but it's actually focused on a better world for everyone. So that's the privilege I've had, I think, of being involved as a head teacher that I wouldn't have had if I'd had another job.
Are you able to find staff that would share those values? Is that part of maybe an interviewing process?
It is. Certainly, I tend to ask the question, what are you all about at the end of an interview, to really dig down into what drives this person? What makes them get out of bed in the morning? Do they have a passion for young people to give them a better life? Or is it just a job? Are they just looking to climb the ladder? Because that's all very well. I'm not saying you shouldn't try and climb the ladder, but people who have a heart for helping children to live their best lives and be people who give back rather than take from society is so important in this day and age.
So, Marcus, you're involved in the local Baptist church and have a particular interest in how Christians so often ignore their impact and involvement in some of the world's ills. And you've written this in a book, Would God Go Shopping? I appreciate it encompasses some of the things you just shared in the previous question, but just giving a summary of the book and what you hope to accomplish in it.
Now, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure Christians so much ignore their impact, but like most of us, from what I just said, are just ignorant of the impacts of consumerism in the world today. Say that the book that I read many years ago opened my eyes to it, and therefore I wrote a book which I thought would be directed particularly at Christians who, like everyone in the developed world economy, go out and go shopping, but often they don't look at where those things come from. Are they sourced ethically? Are they being produced by children who are in child slavery at some point around the world? What's happening to all the pollutants that are produced from those things? And if we don't take personal responsibility for change in the way in which we shop, the biggest thing being we need to shop less, because we all have more than we actually need and we constantly buy things that we want. Firstly, it has a huge impact on people who are less fortunate than ourselves and need to be helped to get out of poverty. But it also has a big impact on the environment, and the sort of statistics in the book as to how much water and how much energy is used to produce things like a pair of jeans. And if people really understood that every time we produce glass or anything made of metal or plastic, there's so much processing that goes into that, so much energy that gets used, that about 400 litres of carbon dioxide is produced for £1 worth of something that has been made, which is a huge amount. People don't think about that when they go shopping. They sort of get, we fly in an aeroplane, we drive in a car, it produces carbon dioxide. But actually, when we go shopping, we're producing carbon dioxide if we're buying things that have been shipped from a long way away and so on. So all those different things were put into the book to help people, Christians, to understand that we do have to do our bit to tackle this, and includes shopping less and shopping ethically as much as we can by looking at, you know, different companies and the ethical practices. And there's a huge debate about that. Some people will say, but if we don't shop, those people wouldn't have jobs at all. But the truth is, a lot of those people got forced into cities away from the rural communities, because actually large companies made that happen as a result of the excessive consumption of the rich people in the West. If anyone wants to look at that a little bit more and doesn't want to read my book, there's a film called The True Cost. You can find it on, I thought, Netflix or something like that. And that really digs down into the real impact of our excessive consumption in the developed world, or on the environment and on other human beings. Quite hard hitting. So, yes, I wrote that book because I just wanted to share what I learned really with other people. One of the things I said in that was that at the turn of the millennium, there was something called the Millennium Assessment. It was conducted by about 1,300 of the world's most prominent scientists, and it was looking at all the ecosystem services, those services which give us everything we need for life, our food, our clean water, our fertile soils, stable climates, and so on. And they concluded that 60% are being run down faster than they're being replenished. And there's only one place that ends up, and that's a really bad place. So everyone understanding we have to do something about this. We have to stop running down the Earth's natural resources faster than they're being replenished, because otherwise there will be big problems down the line. So whether they're Christians or children coming up through the schools that I and colleagues run, we need to get that message across. We have to live differently. We have to live sustainably. And it's not just about being an eco-warrior, because that's the sort of person you are. It's actually having the logic and the understanding to say, no, we all totally depend on the beautiful world that God has created. And if we don't look after it, it can't look after us. So that was at the heart of writing both that book and one I wrote previously called Don't Hide the Truth, which was sort of encouraging teachers to focus on what's really important rather than things that, as I say, often get measured but aren't so valuable.
Sure. And Marcus, the ages of the children that you teach, and I mean, they're very formative, aren't they?
They are, and that's a really good point, because I was reading the other day that I think there's about 1 million neural connections made in a child's brain every second before the age of two. And then it carries on, it slows down a bit until they're five, and then slows down a bit more. So that the age at which they're learning the most and they're most influenced by their education is certainly in primary school. And up to the age of five, it's hugely important to get it right. But what we tend to see is that children who have a passion for these issues, for caring about other people more than themselves, caring about their environment, even though when they're in the teenage years and there's all that pressure to wear the cool trainers and do all the things that are supposedly really important to fit in, they still have that deep down conviction that this is the right way to live. And they tend to come back to it. I went to a talk at our senior school recently by a member of the select committee, environmental chair, and all three of the interviewing students in the sixth form used to be at RSM, my school. And I hope that's something to do with the fact that they got a heart and passion for environmental issues right back then, and they carry that with them into their adulthood and hopefully into jobs in the future.
Well, certainly the youth are making their voices heard. Greta Thunberg.
Yeah,
indeed. And, and she's made a stir, and there'll be others like her.
Yes. I always find her interesting, because what she says is bang on. She's absolutely right on the science. But the way she says it actually switches people off, because she's quite aggressive and tends to attack. So when she's standing up in front of world leaders, having that fantastic platform and privilege of speaking, she tells them off. And in some ways, she's absolutely right to do that, because we have messed up, my generation, but actually it's not the way to get people on side. So I want young people who have the skills to communicate it in an appropriate, non-judgmental way. But they still need to convey the same message as Greta, which is actually right on the nail.
Oh, it's not what you say, it's the way that you say it. Great.
Yeah, yes. Often the case.
Marcus, there'll be teachers and fellow heads listening. Education seems to be a battleground on all kinds of levels. What would be your message to them?
I think, as I said just now, helping young people to become good citizens has to be at the heart of everything that we do. And I absolutely understand that the pressures of inspections and assessments, governing bodies, holding you accountable for the academic results can get in the way of everything else. But I think in all aspects of life, often the urgent eclipses the important, and we have to just carve out time for the things that are important. And if our children end up getting top grades in GCSEs and top grades in A-levels, but they're living in a world where the civilization is tending to collapse around their ears because people can't farm anymore and they're moving to cities that can't house them, and they end up in situations where their communities can't sustain them anymore, and you get sort of civil unrest and breakdown. I think a lot of people don't recognize that's what happened in Syria as a result of 4 years of famine. There were thousands of farmers who ended up going into the cities to look for work because the farms couldn't operate anymore, because all the livestock had died as a result of this ongoing climate-fueled famine. And that was a catalyst for the Civil War, which destroyed the country. And that's just an example of what can and probably will happen if we don't deal with these really significant issues. So going back to your question about my message to heads and to teachers listening is that whatever way you can, get this into the curriculum, get young people to understand the importance of ecosystem services, these systems that look after us all. Help the children to understand that they can't just carry on having more and more stuff because the planet simply can't give it. And giving back more than you take, caring for other people, actually that's the way to happiness and joy in life, not having all the stuff that the adverts constantly tell you that you need. And that is something I think everyone can work into what they teach. But if people say, well, how do I start this? I was talking about ESR. I worked a few years ago with a primary producing, literature producing company called Plan B. That's Plan BEE, all one word. And you can find their ESR resources there about ecosystems and climate change and water scarcity and fulfilled lives and so on. And it's designed for Key Stage 1 and Key Stage 2. So teachers who don't know where to start, it gives a good framework for that. And we found at my school that working into the curriculum wherever you can actually is much easier than you might think. None of us have time to add an extra lesson in. And in the same way as you wouldn't teach kindness, you just say, no, it's just the way we live. ESR has to be just the way we live. It needs to be worked into every facet of a school existence and life. And the development of character has to be around that, as well as being kind and forgiving and helping others and so on. So, yes, please carve out time for it. Don't give up on it. And there are good resources out there. And if anyone ever wants to contact me to say, well, how do you do it, or share good practice, I think that sharing of good practice across schools, again, is ever so important and hugely valuable.
Fabulous. And Marcus, you're obviously in to some degree a privileged place. You, I guess, have sympathy with Christian teachers who are in state schools where there's not a Christian philosophy at all.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah, I have colleagues who work in places where they say they are a lot of the time just doing crowd control. We come from backgrounds where education isn't valued, or you've got families sometimes who even have had several generations who've been on benefits, and therefore they feel that is the way they should live, and that, why do I need an education? And that must be incredibly hard. But I suppose that the heart of all of it is that we just have to live as Christ-like witnesses, don't we? And I was talking to someone a while back, and they were talking about their youth leader who worked in a very deprived part of London back to 20, 30 years ago. And I think this youth leader felt as though they weren't making any difference at all. But actually, when they died, the comment from the young person I was speaking to, now grown up, said, he was the only person I knew really loved me because of the way he behaved. And that was very powerful for them. And they ended up getting into youth ministry as a result of that, because not because someone had taught them anything in particular, but actually showed that even in the trickiness of life and the pressures and these unruly children, they were still loved. And that was hugely impactful. I guess that's what it is, isn't it? If we can be Christ-like, then the love of God will shine through us and actually draw people to him.
Oh, that's terrific, Marcus. Really, a challenge and a blessing to be in that world of influence, tough though it may be. So thank you. Yeah. Well, it's been great to chat with you. Anything I haven't asked you that you'd like to share in closing?
There's, I know you said before you might ask me about favourite authors. One of them was, of course, James Martin, that book that he wrote, The Meaning of the 21st Century. But my other favourite author is Rob Parsons, who he's just written some of the most brilliant books, great for families. And I tend to use them in my school for parents. There's one called Teenagers, which is about your child is about to change and become a very different organism to the one that they were before. And if you read this book, you might be able to cope better with it. The one's about, you know, being a good father, being a good mother. It's called 60-Minute Father, 60-Minute Mother. My favorite book, The Heart of Success, about how to get that work-life balance right and get your priorities right, and lots of others. He just writes really well. For anyone who doesn't know Rob, his background was he was a lawyer working in the city, saw that there were these hugely rich people around him who were quite miserable, very successful in the world's eyes, and yet had sort of sacrificed relationship with family and children and wives and their health and so on to achieve something that wasn't really there. So having worked in the independent world, I see quite a lot of that as well. So I really relate to where he was coming from. So he left the law practice, set up Care for the Family, fantastic charity, and writes all these books. So yeah, I'd recommend him as an author, fantastic author. And for all those parents out there, definitely worth looking at. It's lots of really good practical advice and very easy to read and down to earth.
That's a great recommendation, Marcus. Well, thank you so much for all you shared, and may God continue to enable you to progress in the work that he's called you to do there.
Well, thanks, Andy. I appreciate you having me on, and God bless.
That was Marcus Culverwell, the head teacher of Reigate St. Mary's Preparatory and Choir School. His book, Would God Go Shopping, is available on Amazon. And whether you're a teacher yourself or a head teacher, a parent or grandparent, you will know that those who are in education need our support and prayers as we seek to share the values of wise living and create foundations on which God can build. So if you know a teacher, why not give them a prayer or text them and tell them you're praying for them and encourage them in what they're doing. So this is Andy Peck thanking you for your company and looking forward to the next time. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.